Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this ordinary general meeting. Copies of the minutes of the ordinary general meeting held on 27th of October 2004 have been displayed on the Institute notice board and will be taken as read. May I sign the minutes as a correct record? Thank you. I'd like to extend a particular welcome to our guests tonight. We have Paul Sharma, Department of Risks and Accounting Standards, Financial Services Authority, and a regular attender at our meetings. Welcome, Paul. And his colleague, Ian Tower, also from the FSA. We are expecting a couple of other guests who aren't here yet. I'd like to also extend a welcome to any personal guests of members who are present. All our guests are most welcome to join in our discussion this evening. We have no preliminary business to deal with, so I will pass straight on to our paper tonight, and I'll ask Ikki Iqbal to introduce his paper, Effective Decision Making in a Life Company.
Can you hear me? Okay. Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank the Sessional Meetings Committee for accepting this paper for discussion. Although I commenced drafting it only in March, the process of decision-making has fascinated me for some time. It started during the early 90s when I first became a director of a group of life companies. Although as a team we were committed to addressing all the issues, more needed to be done than we had time and resources available to deploy. Priorities became an issue, and the urgent but ephemeral often got in the way of the fundamental. In 1997, Gordon Brown ceded control of interest rate to the Bank of England, and the government decided to shadow the convergence criteria for the single currency, the euro. That was also the year I first became a consultant. Without the day-to-day responsibilities of a company man, I was freed from having to worry about urgent but strategically unimportant issues. As a result, I could see very clearly the implications of these changes in terms of likely decline in long-term bond yields. Through my firm, I arranged towards the end of 1997 a series of seminars throughout the UK, warning the life industry of the need, amongst other things, to revisit their asset liability profile. The audience must have had other priorities, as few took appropriate action. The message was repeated the following year in a life convention, again to little avail. Eventually, in 2000, we held another series of seminars, this time with Roger Bootle as the keynote speaker. But by then, it was too late, as yields had fallen significantly already, and not enough companies had reacted. The industry's response was intensely depressing for me personally. If such a profoundly threatening message was not being evaluated, then the problem clearly was with the messenger rather than with the message. However, in a perverse sort of way, it was also reassuring, because I and my colleagues from the early 90s were not unusual in letting short-term pressures take precedence over more fundamental issues and common sense. It was a common problem in the industry. When I examined the problem more widely, I realized that it was not peculiar to the industry either. Examples are commonplace in the past decade alone. This led me to explore the field of decision theory and management behavior. Why do management sometimes exhibit collective myopia and at other times behave like lemmings? Why the acceptance of Murphy's inverse law? This is not an actuarial paper. No claim is made to originality. Somewhere in the paper I state that what the paper has to say can be regarded as either profound or trite, and some of you might opt for the latter. However, I do believe that a paper of this nature needs to be discussed, if only as an antidote to the prevailing wisdom that with-profits life companies got into difficulties because of the absence of stochastic modeling. That is utter nonsense. Use of such techniques were long overdue, but companies seldom get into difficulties because of poor measurement techniques. They do so because they make wrong decisions or sit on decisions by calling for more analysis. However, the fact that the Sessional Meetings Committee has seen fit to publish this paper is of is enormously reassuring to me. I look forward to the discussion.
Thank you, Aki. I'll now ask Simon True to open the discussion.
Good evening. I'd just like to start by thanking Aki for a thought-provoking paper, and certainly for those of you who read it, the use of the royal we throughout the paper is certainly unique in my experience. I think it's an important paper because we're in a climate where the actual profession is having its influence reined in. Its ability to manage is being reviewed from all angles. This paper reminds us that actuaries do have positions of considerable influence on, and in many cases direct involvement in, decision-making within life insurance companies. For me, there are two main issues or questions I'd like to focus on which come out of the paper. And that is, to what extent have the management of life companies really made poor decisions in the past? The corollary to that is, do we consider those decisions poor with the benefit of hindsight, or were they truly avoidable at the time? And secondly, does this paper provide us with a robust structure for decision making, which could have avoided the historic problems, and which can be utilised in future? Another main area of interest to me personally was the articulation in the paper of agency costs, one which is growing in recognition as being particularly relevant to firms when determining the true cost of capital. Well, let's start by considering whether historic decisions have indeed been poor, based on the data available at that time. Now, the paper cites a number of examples, and I'm going to consider two of them. First of all, the decision to compete in the stakeholder market. The paper surmises that there are four reasons, or four bases, on which the decision was made. Firstly, there was an incomplete analysis of risk and reward. Or there was an inadequate explanation to the board, or there was inadequate explanation to shareholders, and perhaps in the minority of cases, there was an informed basis on which the risks and rewards were understood by the board and shareholders. I'm afraid I'm not persuaded that the risks and rewards were not understood. The fact that sales experience to date is disappointing does not mean that this was not recognised by companies as a possibility. As the author rightly points out, sales volumes should not be the only metric by which the success of a project is measured. Indeed, the decision to compete in this major market area contains an option value which any analysis of the pros and cons could not ignore. And in practice, the challenge of competing in this market and reducing operating costs to within a 1% world has instigated enormous benefits for companies' expense levels, to say nothing of the boost to the Indian call centre employment market. The second example, the decline in inflation and changes in bond yields. Now, this is a fairly topical subject and for me is a much more compelling example of a decision-making failure, and one which is directly relevant to the actuarial profession. As many of you are aware, this was a key area of concern for the Commons Select Committee earlier in the year, and is certainly exercising the mind of Sir Derek Morris at the present time. Analysis of long-term bond yields did signpost the reduction in inflation and gilt yields, as pointed out by the author in an earlier paper. Undoubtedly, this was an area of interest and relevance to actuaries. So how is it that important decisions were not taken at the time, moving customers out of endowments and into repayment mortgages? I invite the floor to consider, is it that the implications of the analysis were not communicated effectively? Or were management fully aware of the analysis but had a flawed decision-making process? During the Treasury Select Committees, one chief executive of a major life office informed them that his own organisation had not advised him that endowment mortgages were a poor deal until 1999. Can this really be correct? I'd invite respondents to consider whether it was decision-making process or the inadequacy of information flows that led to this flawed situation. I'd like to move now to the second key issue in the paper, and that is whether managing by inequalities really constitutes a panacea in decision making. The concept of management by inequalities, or MBI, is recognised by the author as little more than the application of common sense. And in essence, the method involves determining available resources, establishing the management decisions required, and then, with those two in mind, taking a rational approach to evaluating the relative merits of alternative options. If we took a straw poll now, I'm certain the vast majority of you would say that's exactly how your companies make decisions. I'd be interested to hear from all of you, really, on whether this structure is well utilised, perhaps under another guise. Helpfully, the paper recommends a series of steps which could prevent the repetition of errors of the past. Some of these include an annual statement of critical resources and how they're deployed, an analysis of management attitude to risks and behavioural traits, a blending of management team to make sure that there's the right mix, closer alignment of rewards, management rewards, with shareholders' long-term interests, new accounting standards, external performance reporting, independent computation of profit, and interestingly, echoing what Icky has recently said about being freed from the constraints of running the company, adequate thinking time for management. In the ICAS environment of robust risk management, some of these suggestions certainly resonate as being potentially viable. In particular, extending the concept of capital as a key resource, a restricted resource, to other scarce resources, such as management thinking time, might be an appropriate way forward. I'd just like to move on to my pet subject, which is agency costs. The paper helpfully includes reference to the agency costs, and a feature which is becoming more widely recognised as having a real impact on the value of life companies. For the uninitiated, the basic tenet is that management and shareholder interests are not perfectly aligned, which in turn leads to some value reduction. Empirical evidence across industries suggests that higher free capital leads to an increase in agency costs. This is an interesting concept within a life company, because how much capital is genuinely free? Certainly I feel that the goalposts have moved in the last year, and perhaps with a clearer definition of what might be considered free with the introduction of the ICAS framework. Perhaps this is a topic for a future paper. Returning to one of the recommendations for avoiding the pitfalls of the past, that of aligning management rewards with shareholder long-term interests, I had a very interesting pre-sessional meeting where an unnamed person recalled the situation where, on his first involvement with the board of a company, the first board meeting was spent with half an hour discussion of the results, and then he moved to an hour working on the board subcommittee, which was charged with the purchase of fine art, the budget for which was considerably more than the budget for the board for that year. That, for me, is the definition of agency costs. Anyway, returning to the alignment of management rewards with shareholder long-term interests, I think this has been something that companies have strived for a number of years, and indeed was the driver behind many companies' decisions to align management bonuses with changes in embedded values. It's not my intention to begin a debate on the merits of embedded values as a reporting tool, nor as a basis for executive remuneration. But I would be very interested to hear suggestions as to the correct metric to be used in order to align management decisions more closely with shareholder interests. I'd like to close on a topical, if slightly controversial, note by adding another couple of villains or potential villains to the list of influences in the area of bad decision-making. Weak accounting standards and poor enforcement of those standards. This is obviously, or most obviously, the case where some companies have managed to hide poor acquisitions by keeping excessive goodwill on balance sheets and deferring the recognition of poor management decisions. More controversially, perhaps weak accounting in the past for defined benefit schemes is another example where companies, life offices included, have provided excessive benefits to staff and hidden, to some extent, the resulting cost from shareholders. It is rather surprising, perhaps, that this appears to be condoned with the proposition for a weak standard for pension scheme deficits moving forward when testing solvency for both insurance companies and banks. I hope I've generated some comments which you may want you to respond to as part from your pre-arranged comments on Icky's paper. I'd like to end by thanking Icky once again for this thought-provoking paper, and I look forward to hearing your views.
Thank you, Simon. The discussion will now open to the floor, and it would help me as chairman if I could get a rough indication of those who are planning to contribute to the discussion this evening. Perhaps if you could just give me a show of hands so I know how many people to expect. One? Two. Okay, well, we'll see how we go. Maybe some of you will be moved to speak once we get started. At the meeting a month ago, we had more people wanting to speak than we could get through in the time available. So we've sort of gone from a feast to famine here, but let's see how we get on. I have two people who've notified me that they want to speak. Before I start there, I should just remind everybody that the meeting will be recorded in the normal way. Shouldn't deter you, though. The idea behind recording is just that we can get an accurate record for the journal when the discussion is published, but also to say that if you do speak, you will get a chance to see your remarks and adjust them appropriately before they go into the journal. So don't let that put you off. We may have roving microphones, or you can speak from the lectern if you want to. And if I could ask you to state your name clearly before speaking. And could I ask Ivor Kenner to open the discussion?
Ivor Kenner, good evening. I think this is a very good paper, chiefly in its analysis rather than in its solutions. I do not think that the solutions are quite adequate to the problem. However, I won't bother about dealing with the solutions, only having a limited amount of time at my disposal. It is interesting to read in paragraph 1.2 that the free assets of with-profit life companies fell from 34% in 1985 to 6% in 2002. Having squandered the family silver on over-large payouts related to the bubble bull market, with-profit life companies are now desperate to keep the insolvency wolf from the door. How are life companies attempting to do this? By ploughing their net cash receipts of new money into the stock market to bolster share prices in order to create the impression that all is well. They are throwing good money after bad. In paragraph 3.8, the paper claims to examine, with the benefit of hindsight, decision-making in two key periods during the last 15 years. Hindsight is all very well. However, our motto is making financial sense of the future. Actuaries should take account of what they are told at the time when things are beginning to be done wrong. Here are four examples, all well documented. One, somebody proved that the increase in share values was largely attributable to long-term investment institutions consistently having more cash coming in than was going out. This led to a situation of too much money chasing too few shares. This bumped up share prices, proving what a good investment shares were. Two, Somebody reported that there were no actuarial safeguards governing the selling, or should I say, mis-selling, of personal pensions. Three, somebody pointed out that so-called achieved profits have not in fact been achieved. Using guesswork, achieved profits take credit now for possible profits in the future. Four, somebody said that stakeholder pensions were unlikely to make a go of it on 1% charges. Building society accounts, which are comparatively simple, need more than 1%. Somebody's name escapes me for the moment. More recently, he has also warned against investing customers' money in junk bonds and hedge funds. He has shown the need to prepare for future disinvestment when shares will have to be sold to pay claims, maturities, and pensions. Actuaries and others engaged in life and pensions need to be able to recognise the truth when it is staring them in the face. It is a pity that because of this inability to face the facts, money which should have been invested productively for the future benefit of policyholders and pensioners has simply contributed to a prolonged spending spree. As a result, with profits life assurance and defined benefits pension schemes, the two great achievements of the actuarial profession appear likely to go down the drain. Thank you.
Peter Turvey.
Thank you, President. My name is Peter Turvey. I prepared my remarks last week, found they were considerably longer than 3 minutes, and spent a great deal of time honing them down to 3 minutes, beginning to wish I hadn't bothered. I will just speak slowly. President, ICKY concentrates, I think, on a couple of issues, which are prioritisation of decision-making in the face of the incredible pressures that the industry and management has faced over the last 20 years or so. I want to sort of go back a bit from that and to look at some fundamentals and just consider a couple of those which ICKY touches upon, but I think could do with being developed a little bit further. And those two issues are the management of systemic risk and ensuring that the board's objectives are as close as possible to those of the owners of the business. I'll start with the definition. Systemic risks are external events that, if they occurred, would have a material adverse financial impact on the company. We can all think of examples, but you might think of falling interest rates, moving regulatory goalposts, increased longevity, unexpected legal decisions. You can make up the rest of your list yourselves. And I think one of our problems is that the industry has seriously misjudged the likelihood and or the extent of these events, to the extent that it concluded there was no need to worry about them. A real confusion between it is unlikely to happen and it won't happen or it can't happen. And when these events did happen, the industry was ill prepared. I believe one of the secrets going forwards is the industry has to be much better aware of these systemic risks. In any project you're entering into, the systemic risks must be identified and then managed. No major policy decision should be taken without a formal appraisal of the systemic risks and how they will be managed if they come up. And I think it should be absolutely standard that boards require this, well ahead of the risk assessment that we now all do, but that's after the event, that's when you've actually taken on the business. My second point, President, is corporate objectives. These need to be very clear before you start making decisions, otherwise you're building a house on sand. You need, as Icky pointed out, to minimise the agency costs, and I believe a great deal more effort is needed in this area, better processes. You would think that tasks would be easiest when there was a single intelligent shareholder who understood the business. A nice model for those who are part of an international group, perhaps. But maybe the owner doesn't really understand UK life assurance business. Maybe the owner tries to shoehorn it into an inappropriate business model or reporting model. And in such a case as this, setting objectives may be part of the problem rather than part of the solution. And then the largest case, of course, is when the company is quoted. But here, the vast majority of shareholders will have no understanding of subtle key strategic issues, such as whether or not to get to launch a stakeholder product. I think stakeholders can only be expected, or shareholders can only be expected to opine on very broad objectives, such as dividend policy and capital raising. And I think it's a weakness of UK company law that they only get involved when the decision is already a fait accompli. The word prudential comes readily to mind. I am very happy with the author's concept that in a proprietary company, the board should determine the company's appetite for risk and communicate it to the owners of the business via its words and actions, so that shareholders can decide whether the result is acceptable. And a shareholder in such a company can express his views on whether or not he likes management style by buying or selling shares. And in that sense, you can regard the stock price as something of a moving referendum on the competence of the board. But now the last case is a mutual. In a mutual, the policyholders are also the owners of the business. But there is no analogous process of buying and selling. An owner who does not like the board's policies only has the nuclear option of surrendering his policy, which is a bit like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And I believe that the board of a mutual has to be very, very much more sensitive to the needs and wishes of the owners, and somehow find a way of involving them in major strategic decisions, such as asset mix and expansion or contraction. It is much too easy for the interests of the owners and the management to become misaligned, as Icky points out, especially where the business is struggling. How many examples can we think of optimistic managements of mutuals who've decided to carry on in the hope that something would come up? I haven't got a solution to this apart from hoping that the members of the board are full of integrity, but one little device that might be helpful would be to require an annual report on the underlying profitability of the company and its continued viability as a standalone institution. And while we're in this area, I think I would like to just respond ad hoc to something that Simon True said in introducing the paper. What is the right measure for judging the progress of a company, for judging the progress of a board? The answer is there is no single right measure. One board may validly conclude that the thing to do is to maximise dividends. Another board might conclude that the right thing to do is to maximise embedded value. And both of those are perfectly valid decisions in different companies with different sorts of shareholders and different sorts of shareholders' interests. And I think this is a decision that only the board can take, and I therefore would reject Icky's idea that the profit should be computed externally by an independent expert. It's a lovely idea, but someone's got to decide exactly what basis the profit should be calculated upon and go into little subtle little things like what discount rate should be assumed as well. Thank you, President.
Paul, did you want to say a few words?
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Paul Sharma from the FSA, one of your guests here today. I just wanted to make a few brief comments. Firstly, to thank Icky for his paper. I hope you won't take it amiss if I say that the most important thing about this paper is not any particular thing that it actually says, but that a paper of this sort is being brought to the sessional meeting. And that is by far the most important thing. I hope it is not the... again, I hope Icky will forgive me if I say this. I hope this is not the last paper, but it is the beginning of a series of papers that I brought on this issue to the sessional meeting and to the actuarial profession. I also have a confession to make to Icky, which is when discussing this paper before reviewing it, I started, of course, with a prejudice, and my prejudice is, oh dear, this will be another actuarial paper that takes a problem that is not unique to the life insurance industry and tries to address it solely from actuarial wisdom without sufficient reference to wisdom from outside the profession or indeed the industry. And I'm very happy to say that this is certainly not the approach that has been taken on this paper. The comments so far have not commented in great length about the extent to which you have reviewed the huge amount of learning, the huge amount of research that has taken place outside the actuarial profession on some of these fundamental issues to do with effective decision making. I think that that learning needs to be imbibed into the profession and into the industry. I haven't looked at the syllabus for the students of the profession recently. I've told it's changed quite recently. But I would ask the question, these decision-making theories that Icky has identified, are they on the syllabus? Should they be on the syllabus? Should more about the general approach to management be on the syllabus? I leave that as an open question. I would go on then and extend that point that I've just made and say that when looking back for examples in decision making, when looking back for examples of significant decisions that one can look back on and say that they are poor decisions, that they were made for inadequate reasons, one should not confine one's attention just to the life insurance industry. In many ways, you are too close to the decisions that were made in the life insurance industry. You feel too passionately about them. You've got too much of your past emotional history attached to them. You won't be objective. I'm sure some of you will, but most of you will not be objective when you come to review those decisions and decide was that a good decision or was that not a good decision. You would, and future papers would benefit from focusing on classic wrong decisions that were made in other industries at other times, where you can stand back and be more objective. So I look forward to the future actuarial paper that reviews the decision by Coca-Cola to drop the classic blend and go for a sugary alternative version, or other famous business misdecisions. Now, if I can move on to just one or two comments about the detail of the paper itself. Well, firstly, on the detail of the paper, any paper that in one paragraph can quote Shakespeare's Richard III and in the next paragraph have a double integral. suffice it to say, I found the quote from Shakespearean English easier to interpret than the double integral. But more seriously, there are a number of themes that, even though they are actually not that well brought out, they're only hinted at, there are a number of themes in the paper that I wanted to pick on and just re-emphasise. But before doing that, I would repeat, I think, a point that's been made already, which is this paper does not, the solutions and the recommendations in this paper perhaps you know, the solutions, the recommendations, perhaps should not be taken too seriously. They should be, I think, taken as the beginning of a debate that leads to solutions. And I believe, actually, that's the spirit in which you offer the paper, which is actually to focus attention on decision-making. But nonetheless, there are one or two solutions which I think I would like to comment on. Firstly, the blending of the management team. All of the research that I'm aware of on decision-making all makes the point that the more diverse the decision-making group is, the more open it is to new ideas, the more open it is to hearing traditional ideas challenged. There is the, if you'll forgive the glib phrase, there is the problem of the actuarial monoculture. I know a problem that is being addressed by the profession, but it is the problem of a group of people, all of whom have the same or very similar academic and professional backgrounds, who have had the same professional discipline, who've worked certainly in the same industry throughout their lives and often in the same company throughout their lives. The problem of that creating a monoculture within an organisation, and as I say, one consistent thing that the paper mentions and is brought out consistently in the research is that a monoculture leads to poor decision taking, particularly poor decision taking when the environment changes. And in fact, the situation where you have good decision taking for a very long time, followed by a bout of inexplicably extremely bad decision taking, describes classically what happens when you have a monoculture that is actually quite well adapted to the way the world currently is, but very, very slow to respond to the way that the world becomes. The second big point I wanted to make was that I think a large part of the solution to the decision-making problem, a large part of the solution is culture, not process. The who should report what to whom and what report should be issued, etc., all of that is important, but you get the culture right first, and then that follows. The reporting, one should be very careful about assuming that by changing the process you change the culture. I think it's very much the other way around. Once you have got the culture for the decision making right, the process adapts accordingly. And that leads me on to the third brief point that I wanted to make, which is this, I think, false dichotomy that is being made, not by Icky, but just by one or two of the speakers who have spoken, about was the decision bad, or was it the adequacy of the information flow to the decision maker? Well, for a single decision, that is a rational question to ask. Was it that I made a bad decision based upon the information that I got, or was it that I got inadequate information? For a single decision, that's a good way of looking at things. In the context of continuous decision making, the decision taker must take responsibility for the adequacy of the information flows that come in. In other words, another well-known fact, which I believe the empirical research fully bears out, decision makers get the information and the analysis they deserve. If you don't believe me, watch Yes Minister. Now, I think I've made the essential points that I wanted to make. Diversity, culture, learn from other industries, and as I said in my final remark, don't hide behind the I wasn't given the right information, because not creating the environment in which you are given the right information is the problem. It's not the excuse, it's not the reason why there isn't a problem. That is the decision-making problem in large measure. Thank you.
Right, I think We can now move into a state of the discussion where we don't have such detailed prepared remarks in advance, but do feel free to come forward and join in, even if it's a short contribution or a spontaneous one. Is there anybody you'd like to add to what we've heard already? Don't be shy. Yes.
So I'm David Robinson. I'm a faculty member, and I have spoken in this hall before, but more on academic themes. And I thought this is a really excellent paper. The last meeting I attended in the Institute Hall, Frank Reddington was here, so you can tell how long ago that was. And so, Icky, I'm delighted to have read this paper. I should also say as well, it's the first paper that I've read from end to end without having to leave big chunks of the maths, and the paper being presented to the faculty. I don't know whether David Wick is here or not, but I understand the subject, but I can't get much beyond that, I'm afraid, next week or in early December. Just to share a personal experience with you, which I think is relevant here. I was a member of a management team in the mid to late 90s with a Scottish Mutual, which did take some very brave decisions. We decided not to pursue the pensions boom, not to pursue the investment boom, but to specialise in protection insurance, and that was a decision we took in 1996. And I've often wondered how the hell we did that. So I'm sure that'll be edited. How did we manage to take such a counter sheepherd approach as that? And in the few minutes I've had to think about it just now, I've written down a few thoughts. First of all, was picking up on Paul Sharma's point, we had a very diverse team. We didn't have a team of actuaries. We had male and female, so we had some right brain in the executive team. We had people from other sectors. We had people from the IT sector. We had people from the chemical industry, where risk is very, very much something that has to be managed very carefully. And I think the other thing, being a mutual, we did it all behind closed doors. If we had been a PLC, and if we had gone to the market in 1996 and said, yes, there's a big pensions boom, and yes, the world is marching into investment products, and we'd said, well, we're having none of that, we're going to protection, we would have been told, as we were told when the market discovered what we're doing, that we're absolutely insane. Four years later, that business had grown its market share from 2% of the IFA market to 32%, and it sold the business for a very good deal to a bank. And we did excellent for the policyholders in doing that. But as I say, our ability to do that was driven by a number of things: the makeup of the executive team, the fact that we were able to do it behind closed doors, the fact we had a very supportive board. And the fact we had plenty of different sorts of DNA in the business. That takes me on to a second theme, and that is the analysis of risk. I think that we, as individuals, in anything, it's very difficult to know yourself. You do need external challenge, and I think that is something that most businesses are not good at, is external challenge. And I don't know the answer to this, but whenever I'm talking to journalists or visitors to the business I've set up now, I've set up a protection business for another mutual up in Edinburgh, which I think is doing pretty well. I get loads of visitors, but the visitors who come to the business notice things that I don't see anymore. There are things about the business that when people walk in the door, they say, that's different, and we don't see it. And I'm sure it's the same in the assessment of risk. And I think that it's important for businesses to find mechanisms for generating that external challenge into the business so that they can be shown things that perhaps they weren't aware of. Thinking about other issues today, so I've done risk. Depolarisation. We've got the FSA paper coming out, I would guess, in about a week's time, the end of November, early December. And we've got product providers falling over themselves to line up their strategy. Not as dramatic as it was in 86 when the Financial Services Act was first introduced, but we've got product providers falling over themselves to secure distribution. very much a potentially seismic change in the marketplace is going to happen over the next 12 months, I guess. My hunch is that that many of those businesses will make the same mistakes as they made in 1986. So the fairly disjointed thoughts. I think it's an excellent paper, Ricky. I think I'm very pleased that this has been presented. If you can do two things, perhaps a short paper with the actuarial jokes that you've fed in. I liked Money for Old Hope and the reverse Murphy's Law. Excellent little Mohs. And I also think that this paper should be required reading for all executive teams in any business. I'm certainly taking two copies of this paper back to Edinburgh with me to show to my management team and encourage them to read it so that we get our decision making much better. Thanks.
Right. Anybody else want to chip in? Surely there's somebody who wants to say a few words. Paul.
Paul Seymour, President. You twisted my arm upstairs. Unfortunately, I haven't got a positive example of management decisions made in the past, but I too was prompted to think about some of my own experiences and why they did or didn't work. Peter Turvey said, I think, that he's not concerned about what measures are actually used and different measures are appropriate to different circumstances. Of course, there's a truth in that. But I have a personal view now that we as a profession, and I'm sorry to be introverted, that we as a profession have been too, what shall we say, bedazzled by embedded value. And that has pushed many managements into very illogical, really, decisions. And in particular, it has disguised a point that was made by some speaker I just heard. I'm sorry, I can't remember who. But it has disguised the fact, I think it was Ivor, actually, right at the beginning, that actually we're counting profits before we've made them. And that's a pretty, what shall we say, dangerous thing to do. And it can mean that people will go on flogging uneconomic products in bad ways to customers who don't need them, and mask all that with massive increases, apparent increases in shareholder value, under the name of embedded value accounting. And that is definitely a concern that I have, and I think there may be some of us who still quite like embedded value accounting. In my case, just to be clear about it, and to accept responsibility for it, I suppose, really, we had a subsidiary in Germany in one point in my life, and we thought it was doing wonderfully well because the embedded value figures were absolutely excellent and so on. Well, let me tell you that after I'd left, but never mind, I accept responsibility for this mindset, somebody had to be paid to take the business away. And that's the sort of thing that happens unless you actually use management systems that other people believe in, most notably other buyers believe in. So I just leave you with that thought.
Any other contributions? Anybody want to share some experiences they've had, like our two previous speakers?
I wasn't planning on actually saying anything this evening, so please excuse me if my thoughts are a little jumbled. I've recently completed a dissertation for my MBA in consumer understanding of risk, and as part of this I did a lot of reading on risky decision making, including many of the papers ICIS cited. One of the things I thought when I started looking at this subject was, being an actuary, I knew what risk was. But I soon came to discover it's not quite as straightforward as that. We tend to think of risk in terms of probabilities and being able to place values on things. But what you find when you read some of the literature is that's just perhaps one end of a spectrum of views. There are plenty of authors, like, for example, Kahneman, Tversky with the prospect theory, Einhorn and Hogarth's ambiguity model, and Harvey's heuristic judgment theory, just a few I've come across. And what these authors look at is the behavioural aspects of risk as well as the probability aspects of risk. And what some of the authors have identified is risk isn't a single thing, it's actually a continuum. And there are many different facets of it. At one end, you've got the probabilistic end, which is where we tend to focus and where experts tend to focus. And at the other end, you've got the contextualist end, which is based more on sort of feelings and the context in which decisions are based. I agree with what Paul said about widening the actuarial syllabus to include some of these other aspects of risk, not just probabilities, but also the more behavioural aspects. And one thing that you might expect is, being actuaries, we're always rational and we make rational decisions. I know some of the management decisions I've made have been far from rational, and have demonstrated some of these things like loss aversion and etc. that's in the literature. When you actually read what some of the literature says, and some of the decisions that you get choices of, I think Paul quoted a few from Kahneman and Tversky, Icky quoted some from Kahneman and Tversky in the paper, and they look very simple, and you actually work it out, and the probabilities are the same. And you think, why on earth would people choose this one over that one? But in fact, in practice, it's never that simple. And the reason they chose those simple decisions was to show that how irrational people could be on very simple things. One of the things, I did a session on the research I've done at the Life Conference, and one of the things I did was I talked about representativeness, and I actually threw that over to the audience, and I gave them an example and asked them to vote which they thought was the most likely from four different scenarios. And I wasn't sure whether I would get the rational answer or the behavioural answer, and in fact I got the behavioural answer, and people actually chose the wrong solution because it was more stereotypical of what they expected. There's also an excellent paper, a science paper, about making actuaries less human, which is about behavioural finance. So don't think we've got all the answers. And really, one of the things that we should be doing is being aware of our own fallibilities, I guess, and trying to make more effective decisions by being aware of that and taking on board things from other people and other disciplines as well. Thanks.
Anybody else? Cool. You want a second bite? Sure. No. Well, you can have. You're not limited to 3 minutes this time.
I'll be lucky if I can make this contribution last 3 seconds. Actually, I just really wanted to pick up one thing which he says in 5.2 of the paper. He dismisses game theory. He says something like game theory probably does not apply. I actually want to reject that. I find game theory an interesting topic. I have promised myself I'm going to understand it much better and study it as I carry on from here. I think that game theory is a mathematical way of modelling what is going on in a particular business or a particular industry. And for heaven's sake, that is exactly what we need, is to apply the language and ideas of game theory to the way in which the industry acts, reacts, it competes with each other, it goes through different strategies and so on, which take into account the strategy of other people. There's a book which I found a couple of years ago called Co-opetition. And I can really recommend that as a nice, easy read. There's not a single mathematical formula, not a double integral in sight. But it really is an amusing read, and it left me with all sorts of thoughts as I went through it. I think, what are we missing in the life assurance industry
that other people have discovered as ways of looking in their business. And I would recommend that book to you, Co-Opetition. You can get it off Amazon or anywhere. Thank you.
Right. Anybody else like to contribute? Say a few words to us.
Hello. Yeah, it's my first time here, so I thought I'd just say something. Yeah, two things really. One, a few of you have commented on the inclusion of these sort of behavioural finance theories that Icky's raised in the current syllabus. They're currently there, but like most things in the actuarial exams, a simple acronym and looking at a couple of past exam papers will get you through. I think what's important is that the application of these to the running of a life office is more, you know, brought out further and examined further in future. Picking up on something that Paul said earlier, I think is quite interesting, and from my experiences, I got quite heavily involved in sort of the Morris Review for my consultancy. Getting non-actuarial people, so accountants and lawyers and things, more heavily involved in the decision-making process, which of course will improve our diversification, blah, 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 blah. Well, you know, that's all well and good, and I think the reverse needs to apply. As a profession and as a young member of the profession, I want to see us get more involved in other workings, other people, other companies as risk masters, so that, you know, at the end of the day, there's more work for me to do in the future. Brilliant. All right. That's it. Thanks.
Anybody else? No?
My name's Nigel Masters, and like some of the earlier speakers, I haven't prepared anything either, so this is really a reaction to some of the other comments that I'd heard. Firstly, my thanks to Icky for bringing forward these different aspects, and I certainly agree that greater diversity in our thinking in this hall and getting more ideas in is the lifeblood of what we've been doing. We do get a little focused on doing the same thing better and better, and maybe some new things and some brighter ideas will certainly help. I wanted to just pick up a couple of thoughts at the on the template for the future and some of the things that we could do better. I was certainly struck with some of the issues in point 8, which is about adequate thinking time. I'm not actually convinced that it's adequate thinking time. I actually think it's more challenging thinking. I was quite taken aback in a meeting quite recently where we were talking about ICA and what might go into a capital assessment, and people quite rightly said, well, we ought to think about what are the implications if gene therapy really does what it says it does on the tin, as it were. Because if it does, the problems we've got with longevity now are nothing compared to what we're going to see in 5 years, maybe 6-7 years' time. Now, that is a very frightening capital implication. We don't like to think about those things, but actually that's exactly where we do have to think what would we do if it came to that. So I personally quite like the list, except I suspect that George Bush has already got there to the destabilisation of Saudi Arabia, and I think it's called the Iraq War. But some of the other items I think does repay. And I do think it would be great if we could have a way of thinking out of the box, but within the structures that we have at the moment, so we do capture and look seriously at some of these issues. I can't escape this podium without at least some reference to accounting. I think the answer on embedded values and other measures is you need all of them. I've seen some tremendous improvements in management by using embedded value techniques to pick out companies that were just being run, running their capital into the ground. But on the other hand, it's not the whole answer. You do have to be sceptical about the assumptions. You do have to challenge them. And it certainly isn't the only way forward. And so I think, personally, embedded values are a great piece of management information. They say whether or not they're creating value. I don't think it necessarily tells you whether you're creating funds that you can distribute as shareholder dividends. And I think that that's a slightly different measure. It should be perhaps a more conservative measure. And finally, one thought. Maybe now we're beginning to scratch the surface of management behaviour. We ought to start thinking about what the heck are we putting into the realistic balance sheets as management behaviour, because heaven help us, I'm not sure we've thought about that at all. Thank you very much, President.
Mike.
Mike Kipling. Nigel, I think, started off on a theme that I'd like to continue on, particularly with regard to management. It's quite interesting with the regulatory changes that are taking place within the life insurance industry. Quite a lot more decision-making is actually being put on management for the first time, not the least, at least in theory, in the field that actuaries have kept to themselves for the past 100 years or so, that of actually deciding what valuation basis to use for the year-end valuation. Previously, I thought most management did their best to steer fairly clear of very much involvement in that part of the process at all. And now, for the first time, roundabout now, within the next few weeks, they're going to be presented with a huge raft of decisions about longevity, as Nigel was saying, about what economic assumptions to use in stochastic models, about what allowance to make for future mis-selling costs and other operational risks. A huge quantity of decisions, often in areas where they've never had to make decisions before, are going to have to be made. Now, I do hope, as Nigel said, that the quality of management has improved a lot, because I'd like now to go back to one or two cases that I can recollect of where good quantitative analysis was presented to management and surprising decisions resulted from it, which I think says a little possibly about the ability, at least in the past, of management to actually assess quantitative information, or particularly conflicting quantitative or to balance quantitative and qualitative information, and to know where to place reliance and where not. First example probably goes back about 15 years or so, and relates to a time when as a junior actuary, I was working in the on the sales side of a life company, and asked to produce some sales forecasts for next year. And I went about it in a sort of fairly scientific method, having a look at the sales that had been achieved in the previous year, and thinking what was a reasonable sort of rate of increase in sales. But also having a look at the rate at which business was going off, because the sales force was penalised in terms of its earnings for business that went off the books. And based on recent increased volumes of sales, came up with a sort of net projected earnings figure for the sales force. I thought fairly good scientific analysis. Looked like a reasonably stretching new business sales, but there was a big raft of expected terminations to come to reduce it. And, of course, sales manager took one look at this and said, this is nowhere near challenging enough, and said it's got to be 50% up on what it was last year. It set them some sort of realistic target. The whole of the scientific input of it was ignored, because it didn't give the right answer that was being looked for. And I think that there are examples of that. I can look again, say, at a time that we were been talking about before, about that decision to whether or not to enter stakeholder pensions. I think there were a lot of assumptions that were important there. Probably the most important was the rate of persistency. As assuming a low enough rate of persistency, you could make stakeholder pensions look attractive. But one could do a bit of analysis simply at the rate of turnover within a pension scheme as a whole to see there was a natural rate of turnover of members within the scheme. There was a rate of turnover of which schemes terminated because employers terminated. There was a rate of turnover because employers switched between pensions providers. And then one could build up reasonably scientifically a rate of turnover that made stakeholder pensions look particularly unattractive. And even more so if you looked at the sort of the scenario which actually said the time to enter stakeholder pensions wasn't in 2001. The time to enter stakeholder pensions might be 2011 or 2015, when large funds have been built up. All the initial costs have been met for 15 years, or losses have been met for 15 years, and now there are nice pots you can acquire at a relatively low rate of commission and run off extremely cheaply, and just at the time the original writer was hoping to make some profit. So perhaps the people who haven't entered yet have actually intentionally made that decision and are biding their time on protection business for 10 years, just waiting. Although, again, of course, the government has sort of chickened out and charges are going up and that opportunity is gone as well. So it is difficult to know where, I guess, the decision in that is, because the environment does change. And a decision to get it, to sort of buy at a cost a share of the pensions market for 4 or 5 years may yet turn out to be profitable if the government backs back on charges and charges can actually return to profitable levels again. Coming back to the question of management, what I feel has been lacking over sort of many of the teams of management that I've been advising over the years is a structured and scientific approach to management. Too often decisions have been made on irrational grounds, or indeed possibly on what are irrational grounds when you take into account what what measures are being used to assess the performance of that management. It may be that in fact, if one goes back at least a few years, then what were life insurance company profits? For with profits company, they were pretty stable. It's sort of the good strain, which has got a big momentum going and takes a very long time to stop. 10% of the bonuses every year, and it's going to take 20 years for that potentially, or a huge derailment like the sort of last 2-3 years, for that to suddenly change very much. Whereas what made news, therefore, wasn't the profits from year to year, it was the sales figures. And hence sales figures were a very big driver. And that, in a sense, was a fault of the measurement system for management performance. Embedded value may be a better system for reporting, but, again, it depends upon how sensitive it really is to the assumptions that really count. And I do think that the new FSA regulations, particularly the requirements to hold capital at a level that covers all the risks realistically assessed, and the increasing attention I think that FSA will pay to how that assessment is done and whether it has brought all things into account, is going to make management suddenly have to become much more oriented to managing capital on a scientific basis, to have to understand the risks, to have to get better at balancing the views of a lot of experts. And I think, certainly from, I think that is coming about. I think we'll see more management with a more sort of academic and technical mathematical background, and rather fewer with sort of backgrounds in sales and other areas. And I think that can potentially should be a good thing.
Anybody else? Yes?
My name's Hilary Johnson. As a member of the profession who no longer works as an actuary, I was delighted that a paper such as this was coming to a meeting and that the profession were going to discuss a subject about general management. I've added applied psychology to my actuarial background and work with boards and senior management teams on the human dynamics and culture of organisations. And in my experience working both in our industry and much wider than this, decisions are made on emotional grounds very often rather than on pure rational grounds. And I would agree with Paul Sharma's comments that the diversity of the decision-making group and the culture of that group are the key things to get right to come up with a sensible, rational decision. With the culture is right, as Paul said, the process will emerge and it's far more likely that a rational decision is made. And my real comment is that I'm really encouraged that the profession is open to discussing this sort of thing and thinking about what contribution we can make to how decisions are made, particularly in life insurance companies.
The name's Derek McLean. I'm struck by a few of the comments that people have made this evening. In particular, I certainly welcome this idea that boards of management should be much more balanced and much more open to this kind of rounded approach to problems than by being too technical. But I wonder whether we need to balance that slightly in saying, yes, improve our technical management skills, yes, have boards that are more balanced. But perhaps some of the difficulties that we have faced within our own industry is that we as actuaries have at times not been technical enough and not kept our skills and our strictly technical skills up to speed. I recognise that people have been being frivolous when they've laughed at the double integral in the paper, but there are times within the profession where our mathematical skills have not moved ahead as fast as they could, and we have genuinely been frightened of the double integrals. My second frivolous analysis of what has been said so far relates to an extent to the extent to which, with the benefit of hindsight, we'd have made better decisions and got it right. Perhaps much of our experience during the period that the paper is described is a period in which people have made wrong decisions and done very nicely on the back of it. I think that's particularly true of some of the mutual companies that have made some very foolish decisions and then been fortuitous at the time that they have been taken over. But I think across the industry there have been an awful lot of random noise in the way that those decisions have been rewarded or not. And I think judging some of the other issues with hindsight against that background is perhaps a little tricky. Thank you.
Good evening. My name's Howard Froggatt. As we've entered the frivolous time, can I be a little bit frivolous? We've had mentions of double integrals. In terms of complexity and technical analysis, this is not very advanced, because for a double integral, all one needs is just a single measure of value and time. Now, to assess that over a period, you need a double integral. Now, life offices, in particular, are complex animals. There are lots of independent variables there. And for each independent variable, some of them are independent, some of them actually are not so independent. And if they're independent and stochastic and can change over time, you don't just need a double integral. You need something much more complex.
I thought it. I might just add another sort of historic experience view, going back to some of the earlier comments. And I think it ties in with a number of the points that Higgy's made. I think the important ones are the tendency to follow the herd, and Icky's inverse Murphy's law, or is it Murphy's inverse law, whichever way round it is. I was thinking about the period of reducing bonus rates, and why did firms hang around so long before they actually bit the bullet and started to cut back on bonuses? And it's basically following the herd and the way that firms were perceived in the rest of the market. excuse me. As I remember anguishing about these things over a number of years, and being, as an actuary, happily involved in preparing projections and advice that said that we really should be cutting back bonus rates. What about these scenarios that show inflation and interest rates declining further? Don't they look nasty? And nothing happened for a number of reasons. One was the way that offices were perceived, particularly if you were in the IFA market. If you cut your bonuses more than the person next door, you were weak and all your business moved. Your new business drain just dried up. So there was a huge need to stick with the herd, and nobody, I think, for a few years felt strong enough to take any action that stood out from the crowd, until one particular office actually started to raise its head above the parapet a bit. But even then, it took a long time before a general move in the right direction started to gather some momentum. The other reason was that whenever you present any scenarios, I found that the inverse law came in, or a version of the inverse law came into play, which is that the future is always going to be more optimistic than the actuary says it is. The stock market is going to recover next year. And this went on for, I think, 3 years as markets came down, before, oh dear, perhaps the stock market isn't going to recover. Maybe we need to do something about this. I think management, if you want to, I agree with Icky's sort of approach of saying let's try and do something a bit more objective around the decision-making process. But unfortunately, you need a considerable degree more management objectivity in some of the inputs to make it work. And that, I don't know quite how one achieves that. It seems to me you always have this optimistic view. The man time needed to achieve the mandatory developments that have to be done is always underestimated. Therefore, you've always overestimated the amount of resource you've got available to do these other things when you're trying to make decisions on them. Markets are always going to be better. Your new administration system is always underestimated as to how much it's going to cost, how long it's going to take to get it in. So I'm not sure that the comments about including in your profits a proper allowance for all the future costs of your new business. I think firms actually believe they were doing that. It's just that they hopelessly underestimate what those costs are going to be. Just as a final thought, I thought that perhaps Icky dismissed game theory too easily. I'm no expert in game theory. But I think Icky's comment somewhere is that it doesn't work out as a zero-sum game because everybody lost out, or something along those lines. I suspect that the answer is there's probably some more players in the game that he's failed to identify. And one, I suspect, is actually the customer who might actually have done quite well out of it for a while by getting insurance cheaper than they should have done, or getting higher bonuses than perhaps they should have done for a period. It depends which generation of customer you are, of course. And I wonder whether the regulator is actually a player in that game somewhere too, although I couldn't quite work out what their gain was, apart from perhaps being able to sleep at night. Thank you.
We have time for some more contributions. If anybody wants to share any more experiences with us. Okay, well, if there are no more contributions, then I'll ask Paul Bradshaw if he'll close the discussion.
Thank you. When my wife took the call from Nigel to say, would I sum up his courage for this session, she said to me, he said he was looking for somebody with experience, but I think that means old, Paul. One of my heroes is Warren Buffett, and Warren Buffett describes investment as simple but not easy. And I think that's what Icky refers to in life company management. At one level, it's simple, but it surely isn't easy. In paragraph 9.7, Icky refers to, well, how do you run a life company? You see what you can do, you decide what matters, and then you differentiate them. It does sound terribly easy, doesn't it? I want just to make a few personal comments and then move on to try and summarise the discussion this evening. Whereas I think we should all welcome the opportunity to manage better, one of the themes I'll come on to is that we should welcome external influences. And sometimes when I read this paper and listen to this debate, I wonder if the life industry wears a hair shirt or is over arrogant. And some of the observations in this paper I think are slightly hair shirtish. Picking up on Paul's point, there's lots of other examples other than Coca-Cola who made stupid decisions. I was thinking about the sheer loss of shareholder value in the bid for third generation mobile phone licenses, which seemed to change from being an asset worth invaluable sums of money to something which was more of a liability in the space of about 6 months. Or closer to home, maybe, the customer and shareholder value destruction which occurred in sister industries in split capital trusts or technology funds. I think if you talk to some of the shareholders who own management companies which focused on split capital trusts, maybe those shareholders did rather worse than they did in life companies. I rather think that I support one of Icky's conclusions, because I was actually David Robinson really stole my thunder on this point. I promise you these are my notes, David. But I was thinking about what were the individual best decisions that I'd seen over the last 30 years. Seemed a positive thing to do. And sadly, I came to the conclusion that my number two were the decisions not to do something. The first was what David referred to as a tremendous increase in shareholder mutual ownership value created by refusing to do pensions business when it was self-evident that that company wasn't going to succeed in that market but could succeed in another market. And I think probably that's my number one best decision over the last 30 years, David. You may take that as a reverse indicator. But secondly, my second example was those few companies who recognised that controlled distribution is a specialised, difficult and mostly value-destroying activity. Those companies who recognised that in the 80s went on to prosper. Maybe this old person's advice is we maybe ought to think back to 1988 and the herd instinct to go and move into controlled distribution when we think about a depolarised world. Let me try and sum up this conversation. I think I heard three key themes emerging from the discussion. The first and strongest one was that we as an industry, and certainly, I'm sorry, let me backtrack on that. The one piece of absolute consensus this evening was everybody's welcoming of the paper. And may I add my comments to that as well. I think as everybody agrees, this is huge value as a start to a process which almost by definition will never finish. But the requirement to get both more objective about decision making and put it into syllabus and for us to train it does seem to me pretty fundamental for any business, but most especially a business like the life insurance industry, which is entrusted with other people's money. So three key themes I heard. The first was openness, open doors, and the desire for a diverse team, very much including Paul's comments that the paper itself relies on external academics and hasn't looked particularly at the Institute for Academic Leadership in this area. Hooray, let's open our doors to diverse influences from everywhere. I think everybody agrees that, but it's a little bit like motherhood and apple pie, and certainly my experience is easier said than done. The second point is to learn from and be challenged by outside influences. to hypothesise a board where everybody is genuinely challenging. And I think that is the only way to go against the herd instinct. The third issue, which to me opened up a whole bundle of issues, was the loose area of governance, which I heard covered a lot of areas. Certainly, there were a lot of comments made on accounting. Several comments, several somewhat cynical comments about embedded value. A lot of implied cynicism about the ability of managements to draw up, quote, true and fair accounts. And as somebody has drawn up accounts, can I say it is pretty easy to cheat. But I say that with my tongue in my cheek. One of the lessons that I learned in running a business was that if you have a sales force and you put an incentivization program in for them, you have to change it every year. Why do you have to change it every year? Because a good sales force will learn how to work those rules against you. I don't care how clever you are, how good you are about the rules, you've got to change them every year. And may I say that somewhat cynical appraisal is my only view about how you measure management in a business going forward. You can't decide what you want in the long term. So I drew from this discussion those three points: the necessity for openness, the necessity to be challenged, and the sheer difficulty of governance and making sure that long-term value matches management's. Three other points to make. Looking back, when people were talking about the lessons that Icky tried to draw from historic mistakes, maybe, I certainly didn't hear a consensus that actually any objective decision-making would have changed, particularly the landscape on stakeholder pension. And I must say I share that cynicism. I think it's very difficult if the state tells you you've got to go in one particular direction. It's brave indeed not to go in that direction. Personally, I was a bit disappointed that the conversation focused on that rather than a discussion on Icky's other point about the huge equity madness, can I use that word, that prevailed in the late 90s and the complete reluctance of management teams to listen to an argument that maybe an increased exposure to bonds was a good thing. I was minded, when I read that part of the paper, of Mr. Buffett, my hero, with whom I opened, who in the late 90s, you may well remember, said that he no longer understood what investing was about. But he had the courage to stick with what he did understand. And maybe courage is one of the things you need in making decisions in life companies. Thanks. I hope that was an adequate summing up. I'm going to pass to Icky to close it.
I'm going to invite Icky to respond to the discussion.
Thank you very much. I seem to have stunned people into silence with this. I don't know whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. Some general points. I think Simon True mentioned, and one or two people mentioned over coffee earlier on, my reference to the royal we. And it's really, I had I at the beginning, but it seemed very, it's a very strident paper. And I thought it was a touch too arrogant to have I all throughout the paper. The point was made that value destruction is not unique to life companies, and indeed that is the case. But the paper was about life companies, so I didn't go outside to state examples. Having said that, it's useful to learn from other industries. In many cases, actually quite easy to learn from other industries because it's easier to see the mote in someone else's eye than the beam in your own. But the problem is actually transferring that, say, hey, what does that mean for us? I remember 10 years ago or something, or 15 years ago, laughing at the American Savings and Loans Institution about getting mismatching problems, and yet we were sitting on similar things ourselves. Management objectivity in terms of decision-making actually is quite a challenge. In the earlier draft of this paper, I actually had said, that the only way around it was to have it independently verified. And that got struck out by scrutineers because I'm a consultant, so it might sound biased. But seriously, I think it's very difficult to have a culture where you have internal devil's advocacy. It just does not work. It may work for a year or two, but it won't work forever, because the kind of person who gets to be a chief executive is the kind of person who gets to be chief executive, and he won't often tolerate dissent. A couple of people referred to the suggestion that profits be independently computed. I didn't actually put that forward. I said it would be a good thing, but why should you single out life companies compared to others? On game theory, I think the biggest lesson from game theory is that the true source of identity, of uncertainty, is the actions of others. And to that extent, game theory does apply. Picking up some of the other points in one by one, Simon True wondered whether poor decision-making was a question of process or data. I think Paul Sharma answered that, really, by saying if it's an isolated case, then yeah, it may be so, but if it's generic, then I think data and process are part of the decision-making process anyway. The other thing Simon said in reference to MBI was that he thought that was how companies actually made their decisions, that they did look at what was the options, what were the resources available, and looked at what decisions added most value. That is not my experience from the companies that I've seen. I think generally there is a prioritization process, and the focus is essentially on capital or IT, and not on anything else. And I've seen many companies where you see positive statements from the chief executives, but you actually go into the organization and you find actually it's chaos, because projects are regularly started and canned and people don't know where they are. Ivor Kenner, I think his contribution was, I've heard before actually, probably at Tim Sheldon and Andrew Smith's paper. But the question of free assets falling from 34 to 6%, there are several reasons for that, which I won't go into. But part of it, of course, is that bonus rates, in the past there were margins for bonus rates, it's not really a sensible statistic to use, but it was the only statistic I had going back 18 years. I take on board everything Paul has said. And I think Hilary Johnson made the same point that if you look up, sort out the culture, then the process follows. I think in spirit that is right, but I don't know whether that's completely the case. It's interesting to hear David Robinson talk, actually. And Paul Bradshaw picked up the fact that they were probably one of the successful decision-making organizations over the last 10 years. The other one is Legal & General, actually, which has been quite single-minded in their focus and quite unwavering. Kathy Byrne referred to a wider range of behavioral papers. In fact, Paul Sharma said it should be in our reading syllabus. Actually, there's more progress than is obvious at first sight, actually. There was a paper earlier this year on operational risk in non-life insurance by Tripp and others, where there's quite a bit of reference. And I think slowly it's creeping in. But I think the problem is actually basically rational individuals, and they tend to disregard the behavioral aspects. So whether having it in the literature will necessarily bring about a change in behavior is something to be seen. Adrian talked about herd instinct. Actually, I think it's common not just to our industry, it's common throughout all businesses, actually. If you look at banks, how they compete with each other and look at their own trading performances, it's probably a common human failing. And it may be that with market consistency and all that, effectively that's another aspect of herd instinct, because effectively everyone will converge to the same approach, which reduces the risk of things getting wrong, but also reduces the risk of things coming out of line with others. I think that's all I have to say, really, other than the points that Paul Bradshaw covered. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Icky. Listening to the discussion and reading the paper, it seemed to me that anybody who takes decisions in a management role is taking them in the light of an uncertain future. And the role of actuaries is to explain the implications of alternative courses of action in an uncertain world. And I'm trying to get that down to a short enough phrase to replace actuaries make financial sense of the future. I haven't quite got there yet. I also, as part of what we're trying to do in the changes in our education syllabus, to recognise that actuaries need to understand the business framework within which their work and their advice takes place. And we do, I'm glad to say, now have business awareness in part of our examination syllabus. And the recent chairman of the Education Board, sitting on my left here, did tell me during the course of the evening that we now do allow an MBA as an exemption from in place of a specialist technical subject in our examinations. So we are moving in the right direction there. As a pensions actuary, I was fascinated by listening to people talking about stakeholder pensions from the other side of the fence. I was also fascinated too by the discussion of the impact of falling gilt yields and irrational exuberance in the equity market from a different point of view. I don't know if there are any other pensions actuaries in the audience. I doubt it, since this was very much a life company paper, as its title suggests. I only wish more actuaries would come to listen to discussions on papers on areas, different practice areas, because I'm sure they'd learn a huge amount from them. I'd like to thank Icky on our behalf, not least because he introduced me to a delightful quote from Richie Beno: captaincy is 90% luck and 10% skill, but don't try it without the 10%. I think if you switch the word presidency for captaincy, you're probably about right. Well, I've been very lucky tonight because a large number of you chipped in and joined in the discussion when at one stage it looked as though we might dry up soon after 5:15. So thank you all for that. I think what we lacked in quantity compared with a month ago, we certainly made up for in quality. I thought we had an excellent discussion. I particularly enjoyed two contributions on behavioural finance, and I think the more we have of that thrown into our discussions here, the better. So I'd like to, on your behalf, ask you to join me in thanking the author, Icky Iqbal, opener, Simon True, closer, Paul Bradshaw. Thank you very much. It says on my notes here, it would be helpful if those preparing the transcript of the discussion for the BAJ, if you could hand any prepared notes to Maria Lyons, but that will only apply to one or two of you, I know. The next sessional meeting of the Institute of Actuaries may take place on 5 p.m. on Monday the 24th of January, when it was proposed to have a discussion of my presidential address. However, we may need to change that date because of the possibility of having some meetings to discuss the Morris Review. And so watch this space, and we'll let you know what's happening on that. There is planned to be a sessional meeting on the 24th of January at the moment. If we change it, we'll let you know. I'd now like to warmly invite everybody present to join us in a continuation of the discussion over a glass of wine in the council chamber. Thank you very much. Thank you.